recorded, being recorded today by this little recorder for our note-taking purposes, but then you'll also be audio recorded by WCAI, recorder for WCAI, and then you'll be both visually and audioly recorded by right here, the Fall River Community Media Group, which they will run their video on the frmedia.org website. So, again, my name is Han Chu. I work for the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs, and I manage the Global Warming Solutions Act program for the state. Basically, what we do is we make sure that we implement the law in a way that both internal and external folks are on board. So we work with a lot of state agencies within EA and across the Secretariat to implement the law, and then we do a lot of stakeholder events as well, particularly our implementation advisory committee. So, someone? Okay.
Great, and hi, I'm Claire Maziolik. I work with Han at the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs, and I manage the, she'll be right back, so I'll scoot you now. I manage the decarbonization roadmap study that you will be hearing about tonight.
And Allison Crowley was checking you all in, so she has been interning for us for a few months now. She's a student from UMass, and we really appreciate her help today as well as up to today. So we have for you a little presentation, but before we go into the presentation, just a little logistics. For you all who haven't been here, there are women's and men's bathroom are down the stairs here along the red rail, go along the red rail and then go past the double door, turn left and turn another left before you get to the other double doors. There's also another set of bathroom on the other side of this building. For those who haven't signed in, we will greatly appreciate if you sign in or get checked in by Allison. And then we have snacks and drinks. Please feel free to help yourself throughout the presentation and afterwards. And the slides will be posted online after this meeting, so you don't need to take rigorous notes if you don't want to. So, all right, with that. So in the next 30 to 40 minutes or so, we will be presenting on the Global Warming Solutions Act, our historic greenhouse gas emissions in the state, the recent net zero emissions by 2050 goal, our current analytical and planning process towards net zero by 2050, and some examples of statewide transformation that past research have indicated are necessary for deep decarbonization. That's a mouthful. Deep decarbonization is basically how do we go from an economy that use fossil fuel to an economy that use zero or little fossil fuel. Afterwards, we will open up the mic to have you provide feedback and comments on the information that we will have presented today. We ask that you hold your questions and comments until the end of the presentation, just to make sure that we have sufficient time for you all to provide comments. And your questions may also be answered throughout the presentation as well. So, all right. So, a little historical information, a little background information. The Global Warming Solutions Act was passed in 2008 to address the grave threats of climate change. Its passage made the Commonwealth one of the first states in the nation to move forward with a comprehensive regulatory program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that create climate change. The law requires a comprehensive science-based approach to inventory and reduce our statewide greenhouse gas emissions, charging the Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs to evaluate the total potential costs and economic and non-economic benefits of various reduction measures to the economy, the environment, and public health using the best available economic models, emissions estimation techniques, and other scientific methods. The GWSA also charges the Secretary of EA to set 10-year emissions limits and publish implementation plans to achieve them.
The emissions limits are legally binding. The law requires that the 2020 emissions limit be set between 10 to 25% below the 1990 baseline level. A 2050 emissions limit be at least 80% below the 1990 baseline. An interim emissions limit for 2030 and 2040 that shall maximize the ability of the Commonwealth to meet the 2050 emissions limit. Former Secretary Ian Bowles set the 2020 emissions limit at 25% in 2010 after commissioning an analysis of greenhouse gas emissions reduction from existing policies as well as potential new policies. He published the Clean Energy and Climate Plan for 2020 later that year, outlining a comprehensive suite of policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions across all sectors. Our current secretary, Kathleen Theoharides, is setting the 2030 emissions limit later on this year and has commissioned analysis to inform where she should set that limit, as well as what policies should we pursue to achieve it. She also intends to set the 2050 emissions limit later on in this year as well, following Governor Baker's recent announcement of net zero emissions by 2050. Sorry, did I say emissions limit? I meant net zero emissions goal by 2050. More on this effort later on in this presentation. Okay. In 2016, Governor Baker issued Executive Order 569, establishing an integrated climate change strategy to ensure that efforts to meet greenhouse gas emissions limits are consistent with and supportive of efforts to prepare for and adapt to the impacts of climate change and extreme weather events. Key elements of the executive order was codified in the GWSA in 2018 when Governor Baker signed the $2.4 billion environmental bond bill. Two of those codified key elements are strengthening the resiliency of communities in Massachusetts, and two, developing and implementing a statewide adaptation plan. The Municipal Vulnerability Preparedness Program is the Baker administration's grant program to support municipalities in planning for climate change impacts and implementing priority projects. Currently, 82% of the Commonwealth is participating in this grant program, and we've invested over $33 million across the state to date. The next funding rounds open next month in April, and you can go on the mass.gov website to see contact information for your regional coordinator who can answer project-specific questions. The Commonwealth is also working to improve resiliency within its own agencies. The Resilient MA Action Team is a state's interagency team working to implement the State Hazard Mitigation and Climate Adaptation Plan. In its first year, RMAT has launched an online action tracker on resilientma.org to show our progress in implementing the plan and is working to develop new climate resilience standards and evaluation tools for state agencies. And now we're going to go to our emissions inventory. As mentioned earlier, the GWSA requires an inventory of greenhouse gas emissions to know what the emission sources in our Commonwealth are, their magnitude, as well as to establish a baseline to which emissions reduction progress can be measured. So here is an image of our inventory, which is published by the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. It details annual statewide emissions each year. Much of the data behind the inventory is collected locally and aggregated by federal agencies, such as the U.S. Energy Information Administration and U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. This results in a lag of 2 to 3 years between the end of a calendar year and the corresponding data becoming available. So in 2017, that's the latest year with complete data, emissions are at 73.3 million metric tons of greenhouse gas equivalents, which is 22.4% below the 1990 baseline level. Since 1990, Massachusetts has very successfully reduced electricity emissions due to a combination of low-carbon generation sources and energy efficiency programs like MassSave. I think this should work. Oh,
So here, this here is... Okay.
It's kind of hard for me to do this. Okay. So this here is the non-energy emissions, which is basically ag, industrial combustion of fossil fuel. Right above it is the mobile combustion wedge from transportation, such as vehicles, trucks, boats, airplanes. There is a tiny, tiny wedge which you can't really see, but that's the mobile combustion, the use of electricity in the transportation sector that we call mobile electricity. And next above it is residential combustion, basically the use of fossil fuel, combustion of fossil fuel in homes. Above it is the use of electricity in the residential sector. And then above that in the Navy is combustion of fossil fuel in commercial buildings. And the hash wedge above that is the use of electricity in the commercial sector. And then lastly, above it are the industrial combustion, down here is the industrial emissions of non-CO2, so basically HFCs and other greenhouse gases that are not CO2 from the combustion of fossil fuel. And so the combustion of fossil fuel in industrial processes and buildings are captured in the top room here, and then above that is the use of electricity in the industrial sector. So as you can see, indirect emissions from electricity consumption have decreased, with the commercial sector being still the largest user of electricity. Direct fuel use in homes and offices have decreased per capita, but since population has grown steadily, those emissions have remained at a steady absolute level. Fuel economy standards introduced in the 2000s have also been successful in keeping transportation emissions in check, despite a steady growth in annual vehicle miles traveled. While transitioning to a deeply decarbonized economy will require significant investment in new technologies, such as zero-emission vehicles and renewable energy sources like solar and offshore wind, Massachusetts' efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions have not only not held economic growth back, they have also spurred the development of an innovative, clean energy economy in the Commonwealth, which contributes about $13 billion to Massachusetts' economy, which is about 2.5% of our annual gross state product. In 2017, Massachusetts residents and companies spent nearly $15 billion on natural gas and petroleum, including gasoline, all of which had to be imported from other states or other countries. Transitioning our economy to run on clean or renewable electricity means that almost all of that money could be kept within New England, if not within our state. Now, we're going to transition from historic emissions to future emissions. Okay. And I'm going to pass it over to Claire.
Great. Thank you. So as a state... At the State of the Commonwealth address this January, Governor Baker committed the Commonwealth to achieving the ambitious goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what that means, and we want to hear from you about that as well. So what is net zero emissions? Net zero emissions means that the Commonwealth will need to drive down the amount of greenhouse gases that we emit into the atmosphere to a level equal to the quantity of emissions that we can be taken out of the atmosphere and stored. This graph is illustrative, but shows the historic emissions back to 1990. That actually filled in line here. That brings us to 2017. And then charts out what an 80% greenhouse gas reduction path looks like. This 80 by 50 line. And as well as an alternative, deeper greenhouse gas reductions path represented in the dotted line. In this case, we're showing an X percent, so it's not a particular number here, but X percent of remaining emissions in 2050, but that is equal to the carbon sink shown here as negative X percent. So you can see what we're emitting is equivalent to what we are sequestering and storing.
In this graph,
these negative emission and in the definition we're seeking feedback on for net zero. So these negative emissions or sink can be from biological processes, physical processes, chemical processes, or a combination of them all. So as indicated earlier in the presentation, the EEA secretary plans to set the 2050 emissions limit in light of the net zero emissions goal that was announced. We are looking for feedback on this limit. We're looking to set the what comes out as a dashed line above, and I should note, because she's in the room, Allison Criley, who we gave a shout out while you were outside, but she prepared this graphic, which I think really helps because it's kind of a dense written thing, so I think the graphic can help explain it a little bit better. But we're looking to set what the dashed line should be. What would be the maximum allowable emissions in 2050? And we'd be looking to set that at a level that is at least 80%, that's what the law says right now, which would be the maximum amount of greenhouse gases that we'd be allowed to emit that is balanced by a carbon sink. So we would need to find that balance. So the formal language we seek feedback on, I'll read it and it's stated right there, a level of statewide greenhouse gas emissions that is equal in quantity to the amount of carbon dioxide or its equivalent that is removed from the atmosphere and stored annually by or attributable to the Commonwealth. Provided, however, that in no event shall the level of emissions be greater than a level that is, we're looking for feedback here, at least 80, 85, 90% below the 1990s level. So as you can see in the image, the dashed line represents a ceiling for emissions. So even if we're able to get more sink than that equivalent, our emissions could not exceed that dashed line. In that case, which is represented in the middle there, we would be in a net negative situation. So we'd be actually sequestering more than we'd be emitting. So you can provide comments on this level at the end of the presentation, or also we have a form open online to provide written comments. Our website is up there, mass.gov/2050roadmap, and we're accepting written comments by April 10th of this year by 5 p.m. So in order for us to thoughtfully plan for how the Commonwealth can achieve net zero emissions, we are conducting a roadmap study to decarbonize Massachusetts. And so this is a comprehensive research effort that will identify the strategies, policies, and implementation pathways for Massachusetts to pursue in the next 30 years. The study will characterize impacts of policy implementation, including but not limited to greenhouse gas emissions, costs and benefits, socioeconomic equity, and public health impacts. The research will result in deliverables of a roadmap to 2050 report, which will show how the Commonwealth can achieve net zero emissions, as well as several accompanying technical reports that show how we develop that roadmap. So we'll have the comprehensive version, and then each sector will have a more in-depth technical report. During this process, we will also hone in on actions the Commonwealth could pursue in the next 10 years that will put us on the path to compliance in 2050. 2050 is 30 years out. A lot of things can change, which we're looking at, but we're really going to be focusing on the next 10 years as we develop the Massachusetts Clean Energy and Climate Plan for 2030, as well as setting the 2030 emissions limit, which will put us on that path to 2050. Yeah, no problem. I like to talk quickly in presenting because I'd rather us talk than just me talk. That being said, good point. And I also know exactly what I'm going to say, and you don't have this authority, so well noted. All right, so our study officially kicked off last July when we hired a consultant team. That team is led by the Cadmus Group, and there are several subcontractors working under them. A couple of them that I'll note, AirUp is doing our buildings analysis, and they did work with the Carbon Free Boston report. Evolved Energy Research, they've done several reports on deep decarbonization for many parts of the country and involved in international work, including the Northeast, California, New Jersey, and for the entire United States. And then Harvard Forest that produced the 2013 Changes to the Land report on possible land use futures in Massachusetts. So the beginning of the project was really focused on developing the technical analysis framework, and we worked in, the consultants worked very closely with staff at EEA and other state agencies. We've convened a technical steering committee of local academics, as well as other stakeholders. And then really since then, kind of the middle months, the team has been deep in the technical analysis and modeling work. So we're expecting results to come out in the next couple of months and plan to publish the 2050 roadmap and both the 2050 roadmap and the Clean Energy and Climate Plan for 2030 by December of this year. We've been engaging with various stakeholders throughout the process, particularly members of the GWSA Implementation Advisory Committee, which is a group that's been convening. It's actually set forth in the GWSA law from 2008. They've been convening since, I think, 2012. That is made up of leaders in business, energy, environmental, buildings, transportation, and academic communities in Massachusetts. We've also been closely engaging with climate justice stakeholders to make sure our planning process is inclusive and that the policies and strategies that will result from this process are equitable. Bringing in feedback from the public at this kind of midpoint in the process is important to ensure that we're able to incorporate your feedback into the report. So with that, I'll pass it back to Han.
Great. So I'm going to walk you off to the analytical process for our study. All right. So we are examining 6 to 8 pathways to 2050, 6 or 8 different pathways to achieve net zero by 2050. And so we are using 2 different modeling approaches to attack the problem to attack the problem in 2 different but overlapping ways. So in the blues here, this is an approach, the approach pursued by Cadmus Group, and using 5 different sector models, and then understanding those models, like what are the energy demands are for each of those sectors, as well as like for land use, what are the how much carbon sink can be expected from our natural and working lands. And then that will get rolled up into a net zero GWSA compliant pathway. And then it will get stress tested through a scenario sensitivity analysis. And in that process, we will also analyze policies that can get us the outcomes that are modeled in the pathways. And then we will also analyze the macroeconomic impacts, as well as the distribution of costs and benefits, and health and equity analysis as well. And then we'll then get through a process of prioritization to go from the final pathway and portfolio of policies to a 10-year action plan. That's the Clean Energy and Climate Action for 2030. So that's the process in blue. The process that's in green is pursued by Cadmus's subcontractor, Evolved Energy Research. They have done the deep decarbonization pathway analysis for other entities in other states, and so they're doing it for Massachusetts. And so what they will do is that they're going to analyze the energy demand for all the different sectors in one integrated energy demand model that has been used for other entities.
and then they will run through the same energy supply model to solve for how much of that demand can be solved, can be met by different energy resources. And then that will produce 5 to 7 deep decarbonization pathways to 2050. And that will inform what we should pursue for the 2050 window as well as for the next 10 years. In the reason why we're exploring multiple pathways is that we want to identify the near-term actions regardless of what pathway or possible future may look like, as well as all the critical decision points that we need to address as soon as possible to unlock potential and enable success in the mid and long term. This analysis would open up more opportunity and potential for success of achieving net zero. So that's the why we're doing this comprehensive approach. And then a little more detail on the scenario sensitive analysis. So because from now to 2050, that's am I speaking too fast?
Well, I'll let others. I just have a question because I'm a little bit confused. We're talking about two things here: the technical roadmap, one, and two, the clean energy and climate plan, and one's for 2030, and one's for 2050. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the 2050 is that's the roadmap to 2050 that Claire talked about. It's like a 30-year looking out. It's not as prescriptive as a 10-year action plan that we call the Clean Energy and Climate Plan, but it certainly will have information on what are the strategies, what are the policies that we should pursue now to get us to net zero.
So all this is working towards both those? It's the same process?
Quite, yes.
Yeah, I was just going to add, so we're doing both at once, so we're starting with that 2050 vision to see what that really needs to look like, and then kind of zooming in on the first 10 years and going more in depth and more acutely, you know, do this by then, actions, but it's all within the same study. So we had been calling it the 80 by 50 study, which was a little bit easier in terms of terminology because it had the number there and it had everything kind of falling under that umbrella, but with the net zero goal being announced, that no longer made sense for a name. So it's gotten a little bit harder, but it's all the same research effort.
Okay, so we're gonna talk a little bit of the scenario sensitivity analysis. So 30 years out, it's very hard to predict what the future looks like, and we don't want to predict what the future looks like. In policy planning, what we do want to do is anticipate what are some broad uncertainties that we should plan for that will impact what type of policies we pursue and when. And so we, through a series of stakeholder events and both internal and external, the CAPMIS consulting team has put together four scenarios for us to use that for sensitivity analysis. So what that will mean is the scenario analysis is basically a consistent story, right? A consistent story of what the future could look like. We're not saying this is the best case scenario, this is the worst case scenario, and that we're going to plan for them. It's just like, well, what if the world turns out to be like this? What if the world turns out to be like that? And then we're taking those narratives to inform what aspect of our sector modeling should we tweak so that we understand, oh, in the case where there is high electric vehicle adoption because low cost, what will it look like? But what compared to a case where there is high cost of EVs or high cost of gas, what will the policies, how will the policies differ, or what would our actions need to change in order to still make the GWSA compliance in 2050. So I'll read it because it might be hard to read up here. The first scenario is, before I go into that, the two axes. So we're looking at high technological change for the axis going up and versus a low technological change. And then for the axis that's going left to right, it's low social response against high social response. And so, again, this is very illustrative. It's not saying that we're going to look at every single thing very detailed. It's just just for demonstration purposes. All right. So for A, for scenario A, the uneven technological adoption, we're looking at what happens in a world where EV, electric vehicle adoption, is high due to low costs, and land development sprawls, and renewables and storage grow at a low cost, heat electrification and building efficiency are slow. Versus a scenario B, what we call high inertia, where adoption of an electric vehicle is low for whatever reason, land development continues to sprawl, renewable electricity grows, heat electrification gains traction, but building efficiency loses out. Does that? So this compared to scenario C, what we named slow renewable deployment. And this is where electric vehicles remain expensive, mode shifting becomes more popular, new development is denser, but renewable grows slowly and at a higher cost. Building efficiency grows more steadily. And lastly, the last scenario that we're using for our analytical approach is a high response, high challenge. What it means that we expect high technological change, high social response, but for reasons out of our control, the impacts of climate change are most severe. So basically, electric vehicles and mode shifting are both popular. Population leads to building development that increase in urban, suburban, and rural areas. Building efficiency slows due to warmer weather, and renewables and storage grow. So that's a illustrative narrative for scenario analysis. We're going to transition now to the different pillars, the four pillars of decarbonization and net zero. So there are four primary strategies that we are pursuing to ensure that we reach net zero emissions by 2050. On emissions reduction, we are focusing on increasing energy efficiency, switching to electrified and clean heating transportation, and expanding clean energy. So those are the first three pillars right there. Electrification of heating and transportation is particularly important because we can produce electricity with little to no carbon emissions using renewable technologies, clean energy resources, and battery storage. As such, we need as many of our vehicles, space and water heating, and even cooking equipment to be powered by these clean and renewable energy sources as much as possible, and dare I say, as fast as possible. Some studies have suggested that not every energy-using device in our economy could be electrified. Biofuels and other low-carbon energy resources should be reserved for these applications because they are most challenging or nearly impossible to electrify. An example of this is airplanes. Very hard to fly airplanes that are electrified, especially big ones, and so perhaps a solution for that would be biofuels. The fourth pillar, this one right there, increasing carbon sequestration is critical for achieving net zero emissions, such that any remaining emissions we have in the state in 2050 will be or must be netted with carbon sequestered and stored permanently. And so now I'm going to turn it over to Claire, who's going to go over the examples of different studies. Because our study is still ongoing, we don't have results yet, we don't have anything to present to you, but what we have done is literature review, where we have looked at what other studies have done and what the results have said, and we are presenting to you the results of those studies, just to give you a flavor of what how these four pillars translate into the transformation that will be needed to get to net zero. Again, don't quote these as our study results, just say that just for discussion purposes. Okay.
Oh, sorry. Great. Thanks, Han. So over the next few slides, we'll see examples from other studies on the major transformation they have found since our analysis is still in progress. So we'll use these to demonstrate some of the major shifts we're anticipating to be true for Massachusetts. Some of the decisions these studies and the researchers have made regarding assumptions or a particular technology to achieve the goal may not be what we end up picking. So the likely broader system change that you see here is probably about what we're going to see. So, looking at vehicles first, so this image is taken from the 2018 deep decarbonization study for the Northeast United States and Canada. And on the left, you can see the stock of personal vehicles. So in their analysis, researchers chose to show the total number of vehicles on the road actually growing out to 2050. That was an assumption that they decided to make, that cars, more cars would be on the road in 2050 than are on the road currently. But there's a transition from primarily gasoline internal combustion engine, that's the acronym ICE, a significant transition to just about all electric vehicles for personal vehicles, either plug-in hybrid or battery electric vehicles. And those are the other two acronyms. BEV is battery electric, and PHEV is plug-in hybrid vehicles. And if, for this analysis, that's they found that basically a completely shifting the personal vehicle market was critical to achieve the goals of their study to meet the carbon reduction goals. Our analysis is looking into a wide range of zero carbon vehicles, not just electric, but this is the decision that this analysis took. So the research found that in order to reach full electrification of the light duty vehicles by 2050, and therefore to achieve the carbon reduction goals, the traditional gasoline internal combustion engines were no longer being sold by the mid-2030s. It takes that long to move from the sale of the vehicle to the stock turnover, because some people lease a new car every couple of years, other people drive their cars for 10, 15, 20 years. So it takes a while for the entire stock of cars to transition. So on the right, you can see that even though the amount of electricity needed for vehicles moves from almost nothing in 2020 timeframe to about 400 trillion BTU. That seems like a very big number there, but you know, we're almost using no electricity presently, and then suddenly we're using a ton. The actual amount of energy is much, much less because electric vehicles are much more efficient than gasoline vehicles. So even though we need a lot more electricity than we used to need, we need much, much, much less gasoline, and the total energy that we're producing is we're both decarbonizing with presuming a clean source of electricity, as well as really a much more efficient technology. Several studies have looked at this transition and have also found that sometime in the 2030s, often around 2035, is when the traditional sales of the traditional internal combustion engine end. So this is something that that this wasn't the only study that found it, but this was my favorite graphic that I found from other studies. So moving to how buildings are heated, this image is also taken from the same 2018 Northeast deep decarbonization study and shows that while at present most buildings are heated by fuel oil and natural gas, this is pretty close to Massachusetts' breakdown. And I meant to add, that blue line is electric resistance. I apologize for that not being labeled. I meant to add that, but I forgot. By 2050, these numbers really change in order to reach decarbonization goals. And I should just note that both of these things are happening at once. They're from the same study. So it's not just either decarbonize home heating or decarbonize personal vehicles, but that this study found that you need to do this level of analysis to reach both for an 80% greenhouse gas reduction. So the primary strategy to identified in this analysis was switching from fossil fuel-fired equipment to electric, air, and ground-source heat pumps, which currently have a relatively low penetration in the Northeast. In their analysis, the total residential heating stock is approximately one quarter electric by 2030, two-thirds by 2040, and nearly 90% by 2050. As was the case with electric vehicles, we see on the right that because heat pumps are overall much more efficient, even though the number of actual heat sources is increasing pretty significantly, the total energy needed to supply that is decreasing significantly. And that's because they are both efficient and a low emissions. So we're seeing that for personal vehicles and building heatings, at least from other studies, as we looked, it's likely that we'll be shifting to using more electricity than we do presently. But just a little bit on where that electricity might be coming from. So if you look back in time, as we see on the left, there's a diverse set of fuels that are providing our total energy. This is looking at Massachusetts energy consumption and natural gas, fuel oil, diesel, gasoline. This is across the entire economy. So this is kind of everything that's fueling our lives. But we see there's a lot of different options out there. When you dive into electricity, which is currently about 20% of our energy, in this pie chart here, you can see that renewables are only about 7% of our electricity consumption, of our electricity production. So generating much more electricity from almost entirely clean sources is another huge aspect of this transformation. When looking at the right, we see three relatively recent studies gearing towards 2050. So we have New Jersey, the United States, whole U.S. Scaled down to be about Massachusetts size, and Maryland. And those found that they needed about twice the amount of electricity supply to meet the electrification needs. So when you electrify heating and you electrify a transportation source, you need a lot more electricity. It's about double is what they found. The remaining energy sources are coming from largely renewable sources, low carbon sources, low or no carbon. While this transition may seem daunting, it's helpful to keep in mind that we're already spending a lot of money on all of these resources. So as Han mentioned before, Massachusetts residents spend nearly $15 billion per year on fossil fuels, and those are produced in other states or countries. So if transitioning those energy needs to rely on locally produced renewables helps to keep money in local economies. So back to Han for the land.
Okay, so we don't have results from other studies to show on the land sector. I think a lot of decarbonization studies that have been done are very focused on gross greenhouse gas emissions and not so much on the carbon sink. I could be wrong, but what we do want to present today is some numbers that Harvard Forest have produced for us thus far. And so here is a map of Massachusetts of our land cover in 2017, broken down by very simple classifications: forest, built, cultural grassland, which includes farms, other, and water. And so of that, 3.3 million acres are classified as forests. The built, basically impervious surfaces and buildings and such, that's 1.1 million acres. Cultural grassland is about 0.3 million acres. And from Mass Audubon's latest Losing Grounds report, about 1.35 million acres have been protected of forests, 1.5 million acres of natural working lands, not just forests, have been permanently conserved since, I think, whenever they start keeping track, but that's as of 2019. So as you can see, we are very interested in the role that our forests and other natural lands can play in sequestering carbon. We believe that there is significant potential for these natural lands to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
and recognize that they also provide co-benefits such as wildlife habitat, water filtration, and retention. And so that kind of concludes our presentation. We just want to leave you with a lasting image. Thank you for sticking with us thus far. We want to leave you with a lasting image of what 2050 could look like. So think about the role that you could place, play in the decarbonization of our commonwealth. Think about what you could do to ease this transition. If you're looking for a new vehicle, consider a battery electric vehicle or a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle or other zero emission vehicles. Also consider for your heating and cooling needs, heat pump or other low carbon technologies. And then please consider supporting denser smart growth development in public transit as well as urban forestry in your community. So with that, we will open the meeting to public comment. So what we're going to do is we're going to ask you to line up this way, Alan? Yes. We're going to ask you to line up this way. We have a mic that we're going to turn on, and you have about 3 minutes. We're going to have a little timer to keep us on track, but we have 3 minutes to, you have 3 minutes to ask questions, have responses, have comments, whatever you want to say, and we will take notes. And if it's a clarifying question, we can certainly respond to those questions, but we'll make sure to give you a little extra time for picking up your precious minutes. So, could you see, for everyone who's coming up here to ask questions or provide feedback and comments, if you could state your name, and if you can also state your affiliation, whether that's with an organization or a private citizen, etc.
So my name is Sabrina Davis, and I'm the environmental organizer for the Coalition for Social Justice. I guess my major concern here is that these plans aren't fast enough to sort of offset the damage that's already being done to our planet. There have been a lot of mentions of, like, we have, like, 12 years, I think now 11 years to seriously get our act together before we wipe ourselves out. I know that's kind of grim, but in that case, do you think that there is a way to make it or speed up some of these goals to get towards maybe not even just net zero, but to zero emissions in general?
Can I ask a question back to you?
Yeah.
Do you mean can we speed up our planning process and come up with the plans earlier, or are you saying can we speed up our transition to net zero sooner than 2050?
Speeding up our plans to net zero sooner than 2050.
We'll certainly note that, your feedback. And you can definitely provide written feedback online as well.
Yeah, so that's like one of our major concerns right now. Especially with all the hurricanes, and we're seeing viruses. Cold generally helps to kill off viruses, and as you can see, that's not happening. And plus, with the solar, with the ice caps melting, we're also seeing ancient viruses come back to life. So.
Yeah, we'll note that.
Can I ask a question about your? Are you responding to questions as well?
So if it's a clarifying question, yeah, or we need to clarify, yes, we'll respond. But if it's like a question for us to consider, like for example, net zero sooner and earlier, we'll note that.
But certainly you've heard of the IPCC report, and you know of the timeline she's speaking of. And so you've looked at that while you're assessing these proposals. And what are you thinking as you take all of that information into consideration? This is not news to anybody.
That's why we're going out to comment, to public comment, to see what you advise us on.
Okay, so you're not going to answer her concern, per se.
Not right now. It'll probably be another follow-up report later. Am I correct?
Yeah. Well, we'll be setting the 2050 emissions limit too. I mean, that's really acutely what the feedback on, and we've already heard it several times. Not 2050, call it 2030 or something like that. So I think that'll be most directly noted in that pile of where the tallies go. for how we post that, but I think it's also something that, as much as possible, we're gearing the analysis to. So it's you know, the pace of change is something that we're not in full control of, but definitely well heard.
Thank you.
Hi, good evening. My name is Brian Pearson. I'm from Bike Fall River. I'm the chairman of Bike Fall River. But I also have a few observations from what you were saying. And you're talking about this study, 2050. I'm a former State House employee also. And I've seen 1,000 studies. I've seen administrations come in, and a great example is commuter rail. I've seen study after study that say the same thing, and a lot of money goes to the consultants. And every governor comes in and says, I'm not sure what's the best route. Let's have another study. And after 4 years, it's the same answer. So my question is, Baker's doing this. How do we know that the next governor, is there any mechanism that you're going to have this continuing? Is the legislative branch with this study?
So do you have more?
Well, I do, but I was wondering if you know if the legislative branch is behind this.
So part of our study, I hear you. So my program, we implement the Clean Energy and Climate Plan for 2020, and so we know very well the struggles that we need to go from paper plan to action. So I recognize that. So because of my experience in the last 7 years implementing a plan, we want this study to identify for us who the actors are, when they need to make those actions, so we can then say to the legislator, in our planning process, we recognize that X needs to get done. We, the state, have no authority to do so, but it rests in the legislator. Our study says that you need to get that done by a certain year in order for us to make that transition. So that is our expectation for this analytical planning process to help us with that.
And I also have a concern that the UN has come out with a report. We know that we're starting to run out of time if the scientists are correct. And I'm looking at some issues here in the state. For instance, our public transportation is horrible. It's not designed to bring in the people easily up into the Boston corridor. So you have this situation where people are saying, it's not running on time, it breaks down, so I'm going to use my car. So that's an easy solution right there. You know the problem. Plus, listening to hearing about studying and studying, I hope you're not trying to invent the wheel. We have many countries that have been extremely successful in this. So I'm hoping that they're being looked at, and it'll be easy to take a look at that information. And my last question would be, what would the state want the cities to do? But from what I'm hearing from you tonight is you don't know yet. That's where this study comes in, correct?
I would say the evidence that we showed from other studies is pretty consistent. So electrification, electric vehicles, decarbonized heating sources. I mean, we know where the fossil fuel is used in the country, so finding ways to replace that are probably top of the list for actions that individual cities, towns, you know, regional planning authorities can take. Before I forget, one note on the binding nature. So the emissions limits for 2030 and the one we're looking to set for 2050 are legally binding. So if we miss it, then there's recourse. I don't know exactly what that would look like. You know, that the goal is not to miss it, but it's something that is being held accountable that persists through the administration. That was the
It's legally binding according to who?
So it's according to the inventory.
The GWSA law.
Yeah.
So the law says that we have to have a 2030 emissions limit set, and whatever that is set will be what we need to answer to. The inventory that MassDEP publishes needs to say from now until 2030 if we're going to meet it or not. That's why they're publishing it every year and making sure that the science is sound, is consistent, is the methodology is have buy-in from the scientific community.
Well, okay. Thank you. I just want to say, think of the easy solutions up front. Okay. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sarah Bacher, and I am a student here at BCC. My question is, basically, so the majority of the world's lithium comes from the Atacama Desert in Chile, and with the projected demand in growth, has there been any thought taken into the indigenous people that are going to get pushed out of their land, because they're already fighting with the mining companies for like the precious resources, and is that just going to open up a whole nother batch of problems? Has there been any thought about that?
So while we do recognize that it does happen, our study, we're trying to, as Claire said, that we are engaging climate justice advocates into our process to understand what the different considerations we should have in developing climate mitigation policies. We do recognize that there are certain things that we can pursue within our Commonwealth that might not have as much of an impact internationally. For example, like, we want to make sure that policies that we're pursuing are as equitable as possible to our residents. We can't, the study are not going to look at if it's equitable to folks in Chile or other.
Yeah, that's just like where the majority of lithium comes from. You need lithium for batteries for electricity, you know?
Yeah, I understand.
Also, I had another question. So, what were the repercussions if we pass max emission? Is it like a fine for the state? Like, I'm confused at how that works.
So, yeah, I don't know if there is a fine, but what the state does is that we issue, Mass DEP in 2016 issue declining caps on certain categories of greenhouse gas emissions. So for the energy sector, there are caps on the different generators in the state. If they go above the cap, then I think there is a fine. I believe there is a fine. When we talk about transportation emissions, like, when we talk about building emissions, how are we going to implement that? Each one of you are driving. Each one of you are flying. Are we going to fine you every time you, like, drive above your emissions limit? I don't know. We don't know. So we're just, again, this is exploring, again, our studies exploring different ways that we can do this. What are the equitable ways that we can do this? Cost effectiveness as well as balancing benefits and costs. So we're very much open.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, Joe Callahan. I'm a LSP and an environmental consultant for environmental strategies and management. Also a commissioner for the Southeastern Regional Planning and Economic Development District on behalf of Berkeley. I have similar questions as some of the other speakers in terms of enforcement. How are you going to enforce this? You know, there's a great reliance on personal habits changing. I don't see that happening very, very soon. Is the state going to provide incentives for that? You know, 2050 is right around the corner. I may not meet that, but, the next generation is going to suffer greatly if we don't have an ambitious, you know, attack on this problem, you know, from all phases. You know, you can study it to death, you know, but the science is out there, you know. Look at this winter that we've had. You know, it's crazy, you know. So, and one more question. Have we met the 2020 limit? Or how close have we gotten to the 2020 limit?
Yeah, so like I presented, we have a 2 to 3 year lag time. So the latest year of data that we have is 2070, and that gets us to 22.4% reduction. So we are, what, 1.6? percentage away from 25% reduction by 2020 this year. Mass DEP has declined caps on different emission sources, but they enacted those regulations in 2016 and they had taken effect in 2018. And so those regulations should get us to the 25% reduction
But 2030, you're looking at 80%, 85%, 90%?
The law says at least 80% by 2050. And so they leave it up to the EEA secretary to set the 2030 and 2040 set emissions limit.
Yeah, okay.
So we're listening to you and other folks where she should set the 2030 emissions limit.
And okay. Just one note on the not just relying on personal habits. So we have lawyers on as part of the consultant team who are looking at regulatory authority and kind of what are all the options to make sure that these are met, because as we show, I mean, it's massive transition. So
you talk about land sequestration, and you know we're losing land right and left to development that's going away. You know,
yeah.
Agricultural land, especially for sink usage.
So we're looking for as many options that can be assured on, that can be held accountable as possible.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of it's new. We're looking as far as we can to other states and where it's been done elsewhere, but we'll all see together.
Okay, I hope you take that feedback back to the state.
Thank you.
Hi. My name is Kim Fielding Payne, and I am a resident of Taunton, Massachusetts. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's a little low for me. My name is Kim Fielding Payne, and I'm from Taunton, Massachusetts. I'm a community advocate in Taunton for these types of issues, as well as I'm doing the sustainability certificate program here at BCC. Highly recommended. I actually have a number of things. So I was wondering why local transportation, public transit, wasn't higher on the list of things to attack. Because I really feel like local transit, like giving more money to our local, like CERTA or GATRA, would be a better use of money, because it's less emissions if we're all on public transit, or multimodal, such as biking and walking. With that, more smart growth development, so that we're not having to take transportation all over the place. And it would also cut back on congestion. So I'm wondering why are we not even talking about that, except as a footnote at the end of the presentation. It's not in any of the the columns that you listed.
The four pillars?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. So I believe it's called out. Yeah, we can go back. But for when you're looking at,
I also didn't see it online. And I submitted like a similar comment to your online thing as well, because I didn't see it online.
Familiar. Sorry, I was just
Yeah. Okay. So,
While it may not be called out explicitly here, clearly, but that is something that we are analyzing. We're using the EOPET model to help us analyze the different mode shift.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to go back to that one. So I'm also interested in what are we doing about electric companies as well as municipal electric companies. When do municipal electric companies need to come in line with the standards that are already set for regular electric companies? And when are we going to be transitioning to more renewable fuels in that? Along those lines, we can save all the energy we want, but unless people start reducing the amount of energy we use on frivolous things, one of the speakers was saying, change our habits and change the way we use electricity. So unless we start to reduce and start to not to be as much of a throwaway society, some of this is for naught. So I'm wondering if those things are being looked at. And in line
they
with
are.
That,
just to both of those are being studied.
Okay, good. Thank you. And along with that, I'm wondering, are there going to be reduced reuse policies? Are there going to be public education around these things? Are we either going to set policies that are going to kind of have folks make it easier for them to do these things? In addition to that, are we going to have public education campaigns to help folks, sort of navigate those changes? And like a previous speaker said, you know, we're already in 2020, you know. So going forward, that would be seem like a better thing to be doing. And I know there's another speaker that's going to be talking about the sequestering, and somebody already talked about the land. You know, I'm concerned about, you know, tree loss, about where are we, you know, where are these things going to be happening? I have already had to complain a number of times to folks in my area about people that are just like dumping or abusing wetlands and stuff. And, you know, yeah, those are being brought to local attention, but like all of these things put together are not really helping with the carbon sinks. Or the sequestering, and I'm wondering if you said chemical sequestering and
chemical processes that could sequester.
I'm interested in learning more about that. So if you could put that on your website as well, because I'm not really familiar with chemical sequestering.
Yeah, neither are we. But we're just acknowledging that there are different ways to sequester carbon.
And there are better ways for the environment. As well, yeah.
Our study is not really looking at all the different sequestration methodology, but that we could definitely flag that. It's like, oh, okay, we should definitely have more analysis on this at a later time.
Okay. Yeah, our study is focused on the sequestration from land to see what the potential, particularly of Massachusetts lands, which is largely trees, but other wetlands is part of the analysis too.
Yep.
That's what we are going to quantify. But there's need for more study as sink, you know, coming up with a number for sink becomes more of a real target for the state. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And with the transportation, remember, it's not only like getting in and out of Boston, but it's also local transportation within local communities like Fall River or Taunton or the like. I'm going to sneak past you because I'm on that side.
Yeah. Thank you.
My name is Nancy Lee Wood. I teach here at Bristol Community College, and I'm a resident and voter in Taunton, Massachusetts. I have two key concerns. I'll talk about the lesser one first, and that is mass transportation. It takes between 30 and 70 barrels of oil to make a vehicle, depending on the size of the vehicle. Long before it comes off an assembly line to use any form of energy. And so my key question is, why are we even contemplating more vehicles on a road when we really need to have mass transit set up all over the state, all over the country? This is absolutely critical. As we know, fossil fuels are finite, and we are wasting them on privatized vehicles. We need mass transit systems if we're going to be using this precious, precious item that we have of oil. We need to be constructing vehicles that are going to get large numbers of people moving around into various parts of the state and the country. That's a lesser concern. My key concern is I think that much of what I've seen here is not understanding that we have a huge carbon sink in the ocean, and that every year humankind emits 130 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere, but we only draw down 120 billion tons. We've been doing this for 60 years, which means we have 600 billion tons of carbon that is in the ocean that wants to be released. Once we start drawing down, no matter how we draw down, carbon dioxide from the atmosphere into the soil, the oceans are going to want to release the extra carbon that they have, that all of them have. And that is going to get released into the atmosphere, which means if we're thinking only of drawing down what we're emitting, it is way off track. Because it's not simply what we're emitting today, it's what we've been emitting over the last 60 years that is also going to have to be drawn down. So I see this whole scenario as being extremely limited. It is not taking into consideration the massive drawdown that we're going to have to do. And it's not going to be by chemicals. We have to do it by natural elements. We need reforestation all over the state, all over the country. We need to restore our wetlands. This college could not be built on this land today because we're on wetlands. Okay? We need to stop the kind of industrial agriculture that's happening all across the country and the world. These are critical issues, and they're far, far more important, I think, than thinking about some of the issues as they've been presented here. With all due respect, this is kindergarten compared to what we really have facing us. And I hope that you take that back to the state.
Thank you for your work. I know you've worked hard. My name's Annie Hayes. I live in Wareham, Mass. And my concern is that fossil fuels are increasingly kept in the ground. I think that's the way that we have to deal with them. The fact that we still have subsidies for fossil fuels is obscene and criminal. And the best way that I have learned of, and a guy named Nordhaus won a Nobel Prize for the economics of this, is to tax carbon where it's extracted from the earth. So the market is used. The carbon price, of course, goes into all the carbon products as the fossil fuels company raise that price. But that fee is collected, the taxed fee, and redistributed to the American people so that they have money to, and the least well off have the most, or not the most money, you know, that doesn't sound right, but more money relatively to pay for what the additional cost of that taxed carbon is. But people have a choice. They see all of this in the market, and they see that a carbon price is rising incrementally by the ton every year, and they have a choice because the products that are not made with so much fossil fuels become more viable, and the market is making this adjustment as the fossil fuels become more and more less viable. The thing that I've read recently that really disturbs me is that fossil fuel companies have no intention of keeping petroleum in the earth. They have Plan B, which is they've already instigated, is to push as much plastic into our environment, into our lives as possible. And we know it's already in our bodies. We know how it's in the ocean. We know all these little bits everywhere. We have got to stop these bastards, and we need to make them pay, and that's the way they're going to do it. So it's a matter of this may be a part of the situation, but we need propaganda, let's call it that. And we need strong politicians who are saying, we're going to tax these guys. They're worse than smoking companies. They're killing us. So let's get on it as citizens who are here, and as politicians. And I, for one, I mean, there's H.R. 763 in the House right now. It's got almost 100 proponents. William Keating from my district will not go near it. I mean, talk and lobby, Citizens Climate Lobby, go to his office, bring him brownies, you know, for God's sake. Not for brownies will he sign on to this. I mean, so we have to really work hard at these.
I'm Laura Gardner. I'm resident of Fairhaven, Mass, and a mother and also co-chair of our new Climate Reality Massachusetts South Coast group. And I just want to thank you for your work, but I want to echo some things that a lot of other people have said, that I just feel like this doesn't move fast enough, and I am terrified for our future as it stands right now. And, you know, I am a librarian, and I believe very strongly in research, but at a certain point, I feel like, you know, we need to move past the studies and get into action. And we know there are things that work. We know that, you know, local transportation is essential and important, and we have terrible transportation here on the South Coast. CERTA is awful. And, you know, there are other communities that have moved fast on improving their local transportation, and it's made a huge difference. When I went to the Climate Reality Conference last summer in Minneapolis, they have electrified buses, and they have ad campaigns where people are on the buses in a bus-only lane that moves faster than the rest of the traffic, waving at the people in their cars as the people in their cars sit and don't move. And you want to know, that gets people on the bus. It gets everybody on the bus, not just low-income people, but people trying to get to their white-collar jobs, all the people on the bus. We all need to get on the buses. And so if we know some things that work, I want to start moving on those things. I want to start seeing action. And, you know, I want to see it faster than this. Net zero by 2050 is not soon enough for my children. And we're just one state in this country. We just have to all move a lot faster, and we need to be more ambitious, and we need to push our politicians to do the right thing in this case. So thank you, though, for your work.
Thanks. My name is Stephen Dodge. I live in Pembroke, and I represent the Bastards. I'm executive director of the Massachusetts Petroleum Council, and I know that sometimes we're considered the skunk at the garden party at these type of events. And I always try to assure people that that's not really the case. One of our largest companies, BP, announced net zero emissions by 2050. A lot of our major companies have supported a nationwide carbon tax. And we have been working with the administration on the Georgetown transportation cap and trade proposal. So as I say, we represent big energy and not big oil. But I do have one question. I think it's a legitimate one. Throughout this process, is there going to be any focus on costs? I think we all acknowledge, and you mentioned this a little bit to the addressing the student's question, there are going to be massive costs associated with transforming the transportation sector, with the building thermal sector. We all already have the highest utility costs in the country. There's a danger there. Will the modeling reflect the potential impediments to the huge costs that are ultimately associated with all this?
Yes, we are. That's a very big component. In one of the slides, Claire says that we'll be looking at the cost and the economic impact as well. And so that's something that we will be looking at. We are, each of the sector models, say the land use sector model, have cost analysis built into it. And then we have at the end, a macroeconomic model that we will run, well, the academics will run in plan to help us figure out, like, as an aggregate, how much of these policies will impact different groups of people.
For, like, jobs analysis and which jobs where moving in, how the money's spent.
I just also want to add, we really do applaud this process. It's one thing to set a statute and these goals and objectives, and in Massachusetts, they're not goals. They're mandatory, as we know. And to develop, for the administration to put all this effort in to develop a realistic roadmap, I think really makes sense. Other states are not doing that, so we applaud this effort.
Thanks.
Hello, my name is Trot Lee, city councilor in Fall River. So the last person who just spoke, I had a very similar approach as to what it's going to be financially for municipalities, as well as some guidance. I think is important for people who are concerned about their families, people who are concerned about their local environments. The local transportation has been spoken about, but I need to, as a city councilor, I would like to see how local programs can be implemented and presented to the people, the public. I think you're going to have a lot more backing publicly if you are showing people not the environmental benefits, but also the financial benefits to making changes in their environment. And I know that we were this. Am I wrong? Am I thinking that this is sort of a work in progress? This process. So I would think that you are that public perception and public gathering is also important. So again, I say, if they know the financial benefits, but also the environmental benefits and the local benefits of these changes, I think that you're going to have a lot more positive impact on the community with it. There are some heavy amounts of information when it comes to carbon and when it comes to carbon, making our environment clean based on that. When it comes to the ocean, air, everything else is that. But I think that the everyday working man and woman or family, they want to know how it's going to impact their immediate everyday life as well. So thank you.
Thank you. If we do have a couple of minutes, if there's anyone else who would like to come down and well, you maybe thinking about it, I just wanted to reiterate that on the website, mass.gov/2050roadmap, we have both a specific question form for 2050 limits. If you made a comment to that effect, we have you recorded and in our notes, so you don't have to reiterate it, although you're welcome to, or if you want to elaborate. And we also have a opportunity to sign up for a mailing list to get more information about this effort, as well as a kind of general feedback form on anything that might come to mind on this. So to the last point on kind of messaging around, it takes all of us to make these things happen. And so around the messaging, ideas and that type of thing are very much welcome, because this is a work in progress. It will be published by the end of this year, but we still have many months to go with our research and then also how it's framed. But yeah, great. A couple more comments.
My name is Donnie McGee. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I just moved to Fall River, lived in Taunton, used to teach here at Bristol. I'm very concerned, obviously, with the environment, the warming of the ozone and the rising seas and all of that, and I appreciate the analysis. I think a lot of the frustration here was because I think maybe people expected to see more of the implementation phase. And one of the things that I was tuned into when you were giving the presentation was on the grant programs that thinking about initiating or have initiated. I don't know if that's something that you're just saying this is what we should do, but it looked like there was some kind of partnering or consideration of partnering with municipalities, because what we do as individuals is important, but it's the big things like what's happening at the town and cities in terms of planning for building construction or land. Or, I lived in Berkeley for a while, and I know the planning board had oversight of, what wetlands should be preserved, which weren't clear cutting. These are things that I think are happening across the state, and I'm just curious as to how are these grant programs going to be implemented, or are they? What is the connection between municipalities? What is being done in other communities that could be shared? I mean, is there anything in progress at this point? I guess the other question is, what kind of oversight does the state have over what's going on in cities and towns in terms of filling of wetlands, clear cutting, taking over farmland, preservation of land so they're not developed? I don't know, that was a lot of questions, but I guess I want to know what's happening or how it's going to happen if it hasn't happened.
So thank you for that question. At the end of 2018, the GWSA says that we have to have a limit for each decade and then a plan to implement those, to reach those limits. And then every 5 years, we have to produce a report to summarize the progress that we're making in implementing these plans. And so we put together the 5-year and the 10-year progress report. The 10-year progress report was released at the end of 2018. And so in here, in the 77 pages, you'll get to read all the different policies and regulations and programs that we have implemented to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The slide that you're referring to is on the adaptation, which I can definitely ask my colleagues if there are reports that are out there that kind of summarize the different adaptation, implementation, results, facts that you're interested in. But definitely for mitigation, you can definitely read that report. We don't have internet, so I can't pull it up, but you can go to Google, say GWSA implementation, and then it should pull you up to our website, which outlines how we're doing to meet the 2020 emissions limit. What are the different policies we have implemented, how those policies have stacked up in terms of greenhouse gas reductions. So.
Okay. One other question, the environmental bond bill, what is that Can that is at the State House now being?
No, it passed and it was signed into law already. It was passed and then it was signed by Governor Baker in 2018, which codified elements of the Executive Order 579 into law. So you can definitely, if you Google Environmental Bond Bill, $2.5 billion, 2018, Governor Baker, you should be able to get to that.
Okay, thank you.
Hello, my name's Ruth. I'm a student here at BCC. I'm a student here at BCC. My name's Ruth. I'm also an engineering student minoring in the sustainability studies. So one concern that I had was that whatever is coming to us is going to come to us regardless of what we do, because I feel like we've started too late. And to be very honest, like 10 years and it's not just, there's so many roadblocks. It's hard to really, really believe and be optimistic about the fact that we're going to hit that mark. I mean, I could be wrong, but so one thing that I was mostly concerned about was how the state is going to prepare people who are very vulnerable to these changes. You know, there's lots of people who have, you know, people who are older who are very sensitive to the rapid fluctuations in temperature. You know, how are we going to protect those people, you know, when they're in their homes and it's just unnaturally hot or whatever kinds of conditions, hurricanes, floodings, and people have to constantly rebuild their lives over and over again. I mean, just seeing, you know, sort of with the pandemic that's happening, well, seeming pandemic that's happening right now, it appears as that's going to happen more often, and it seems like we're ill-equipped for things like that. How are we going? Does the state have any plans to make us resilient to these? Because I think it would be a little bit too nearsighted to say, yeah, we don't have to think about any of that stuff because we're going to reach these goals, when there's already so many roadblocks in our ways in terms of big businesses and just politicians who don't care about people. I just don't see how that's going to happen in 10 years. So I think what's really important is that we prepare people who are sort of marginalized in society. How are they going to be able to survive these extreme conditions? So that's kind of my concern, and just wondering if that's factored in any of your plans on how to help people who are very vulnerable to climate change.
Yeah. So thank you, Ruth, for your comment and concern. Thank you. Yes, so in terms of resiliency and adaptation, we certainly are working really closely with our colleagues in EEA to make sure that climate mitigation policies are not at odds with adaptation efforts. On adaptation, Governor Baker have put millions and millions of dollars into giving it to different municipalities to help them with the planning to address vulnerable populations, to address critical infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. We are also looking for support for S10 to get additional funding for adaptation efforts. So definitely talk to your legislators. Okay. Lawmakers to support S10.
Awesome, thanks. And one more thing. So this is the first time that the state's actually being held accountable to reaching these goals, right? It's like I remember earlier someone mentioned there's been study after study, study after study. So this time is like I think I heard you say there were fines or consequences for not reaching these goals. Is this the first time that this has happened?
So the 2020 limit, we won't know until after 2020 if we hit that or not. And if we don't, then that'll be that's the first target that we have down for being held accountable. I will say that there was legislation a number of years ago, litigation a number of years ago when reading through the report, it said that there should be regulations out there. And they said, where are the regulations? And so the state was sued and regulations followed. So we have seen it happen, and those were specifically the declining caps for electricity that we mentioned. So I think that it's the structure of the law it kind of enables that type of accountability to be held.
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I would say probably the last comment or now over time, but sorry, you I think are the last one.
Yeah.
Line, so we'll...
Yeah, apologies if those.
Yeah, anyone
if
who
you
needs
don't
to leave,
waiting.
You can leave. We will stay here. So,
I just wanted to thank you all for choosing a noble profession that seeks to solve this Herculean problem. So that's very important. Secondly, I'd like to thank the state officials who have found the money to do this study. And also I'd like to thank all of you for taking time out of your busy schedules to come here. My name is Joe DeSilva. I teach sustainable renewable energy here at Bristol Community College. My only recommendation would be that the state needs to lead by example. There is a lot of opportunity at the state level for net zero and has been for a number of years. That would be a great, noble first step. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for that. And just want to give you, there is a leading by example executive order that will come out later this year. So thank you for that note. Be on the hook for that. Be
on the look for it.
Look for that.
That concludes the meeting today. As I mentioned before, the public comment is open. And please, there are to-go boxes if for any snacks, if there are any remaining, to please take them home. And thank you, everyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
See you soon.
Stop.